We are in Romans 4. There's Mr. Cathy. We have been discussing Paul's argument. We will continue to discuss Paul's argument all the way through chapter 11, at which time Paul will be done with his argument. His argument begins in chapter 1, verses 16 and 17, which is also known as what? The thesis. He then, using a rhetorical method known as diatribe, very popular and prevalent in the ancient world, presents his antithesis. The thesis is basically the righteousness of God is revealed, and so that becomes the topic he wants to discuss. The antithesis, the wrath of God is revealed. He then goes on to discuss how that takes place and what his proof is for that. He answers a few questions on the way, like, Paul, how could you say this? You know, the judging issue, and how the law is important and yet not totally self-sufficient. He then gets to chapter 3, verses 21 and following, and discusses his thesis statement that God is doing something, that God has been doing something and continues to do something, and then provides an example of his thesis statement. The example is Abraham. The thesis statement is the righteousness of God is revealed. It's not through the law. And his example is Abraham, who was declared righteous while he was uncircumcised before the giving of the law. So he talks about Abraham's example, who by faith was declared righteous. And then he goes on to talk about this faith of Abraham and what it's like, because it's that kind of faith that actually has one declared righteous, not just any old type of faith. How many of you bought Girl Scout cookies? Okay. I already had the time. Time's over unless you can find somebody who ordered too many. What kind do you buy, Jacqueline?
There's only one kind of Girl Scout cookie, right? Thin mints. It's the only thing worth. Yeah, one package a day. I limit myself to one sleeve a day. Limit it? It's hard. Otherwise, they'd eat the whole box, you know. But, well, we could talk about Girl Scout cookies. We could talk about cookies, right? Now, there's Oreos, and then there's double stuff Oreos. Which are better? Those are way better, right? So I could say cookie, and you have some image of a cookie. But then there are those special cookies, like Thin Mint, double stuffed Oreos, and my own personal favorite, the peanut butter oatmeal pecan chocolate chip cookie that I make. My house. Yeah. And my son said, after eating several, my youngest, those are really good, Dad. Because they always are really good. They're a little moist this time. I'm not quite figuring it out, but I just got in a baking mood Saturday, so. I think we have two cookies left out of the 64 that were baked. But that's what happens when you have teenagers around. In the same way, and I am trying to get somewhere, Seth. Okay, I'm not just wandering. Yeah. There is faith, and then there is that kind of faith Paul is talking about. And that's why he discusses Abraham, because he does not want his audience to jump to the conclusion that there is a faith unspecified that they have to guess at that results in justification, the making or declaration of righteousness. And in doing so, we introduced three terms, which will be at least 3 points on the test, of intertextuality, intratextuality, and allusion. Intertextuality is what Paul does when he introduces the person of Abram, or, as he's known in Paul's day, Abraham. He is referring to another text, another story, another book,
that talks about Abraham. And if you have not read that book, you don't understand what he's saying about Abraham. And that is the problem that we have today. Most of the movies I watched were in the 1970s. And then they were shown as reruns. Most of the movies you watch are remakes of the movies I watched in the 1970s. In fact, I was watching last night the Thomas Crown Affair. Know that one? Good job, James. Very interesting story. Got this great, great little comic situation at the end where he comes in and all these guys come in with hats. And so it's been used many times and various. But this was the 1968 edition with Steve McQueen. 1968. Steve McQueen, pretty important. So the Thomas Crown Affair that I became familiar with is actually a remake of the Thomas Crown Affair of earlier. And it's about this guy who's got too much money for his own good and masterminds this crime just for fun. Sounds like a plot in many of the movies of today. So I could make references to the Thomas Crown Affair and it would go over like most of my jokes. You wouldn't get it. Why? Because you're stupid? No! Don't even think such a thing. Meganoita! See, now you have an intratextual illusion, don't you? But because you simply don't know the story about which I am making reference to. Intertextuality is referring to another story. If you want to get good at understanding Romans, read Genesis. You'll understand it better. In fact, read the Old Testament. You'll understand it better. But if you want to understand what Paul is trying to say, you have to use intratextuality because he is referring back and continues to refer back to things that he has said before. He does not just state a point, leave it, go on, and introduce new material. He consistently comes back to discuss a topic. It's a different way of writing. And so we have intertextuality and intratextuality. And then that third word that we introduced at the end of the hour, very difficult to define, is simply allusion. Not illusion. Any Monk fans in here? See, I can make reference to Monk because it's a modern TV show. Some people like it. He's a little bit extreme in certain ways, but I just watched about 2 weeks ago Monk and the Magician. The Magician was an illusionist with an I, not an A. See, that would be helpful if I was asking you to write out these responses, that you spelled it correctly. Because if you started with an I, Melissa, and then have two L's, I must think you're talking about a magician. Rather than starting it with an A and double L, and it's an allusion in which one's alluding to something, but they only say it partially. You may think they're alluding to something. Right? You're having a conversation this weekend. Someone said something and you jumped to a conclusion. You thought that they were alluding to something. Like, no, I'm not talking about that at all. But you got a glimmer. You got a whiff of the barbecue. A whiff of the smoke. Or as around my neighborhood lately, the dead skunk. Right? You go. That does not smell good. I don't know where it's coming from, but I think I know what it is. And you drive around the neighborhood, and there's no dead skunk on the road. But somewhere, the wind is blowing that whiff by. And you think they're referring to it. But sometimes they are. You're in a discussion with somebody, some significant other, and they make reference to something that happened 10 years ago. Well, maybe in your lives 3 years ago. Or 3 months ago. Or 10 days ago. Take your pick. And you know exactly what they're referring to, because they're wanting to jab you with something you didn't do. It doesn't have to be a significant other. It could be a parent who might remind you of something. Or what's always lovely, those aunts and uncles you go visit. who remember you when they changed your diapers. That's a lovely memory to be brought up at family reunions, isn't it? Okay. So an illusion is just kind of vaporish. It just kind of comes and goes, and you're not quite sure exactly what he's alluding to, but you kind of get the idea. So when we look at Abraham's faith, which is being described here, we see lots of nice characteristics. It says that Abraham did not weaken in faith. So the first type of thing that Paul is talking about is a faith that does not weaken. Now that's kind of interesting, because when we think about faith, we have an antonym for faith, and we call it what? Well, that's in this class.
Fear?
Now, what do we call the opposite of faith? Doubt! He's not talking about doubt. See, he's talking about weakening in faith. Now, has he talked about people being weak before? See, now, what kind of allusion is he making? Intratextual. What does it mean to weaken in faith? Ask Paul where he's talked about it earlier. And then we kind of have enough knowledge about Romans to know that in chapter 14 and 15, he talks about those who are strong in the faith and weak in the faith. And when we get to chapter 14 and 15, is he actually just talking about some new topic, or is perhaps he making a reference all the way back to chapter 4 about being strong in the faith, not weakening in the faith? See, if we just read it in a linear fashion, we go, bumpity, 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 we're at the end. If we begin to read it like Paul's discussing it, we go, I'm getting a little dizzy with all the references back to the beginning. So the first thing we know is he didn't have any weakness in his faith when he did what? He considered his own body already as good as dead, or the barrenness of Sarah's womb. God says, you're going to have a child. In fact, Sarah's going to have the child. And he goes, okay. I'm 99 and she's 90, and we've been at this a long, long, long time. And here I could go off in something about, you know, sexual reproduction cycles or something like that. But not everybody who engages in sexual reproductive cycles is as fortunate as Abraham and Sarah to not get pregnant the first time. But that would be beyond Romans, right? Speaking of a hawk, see, I told you it had something to do with octuplets. Right? Right here. The barrenness of her womb. There you go. So fertility drugs. Opposite is relevant. And what else happens? If you know Genesis, a few chapters later from chapter 17 when the covenant is made and Isaac's born, about chapter 20 and chapter 22. Anybody know what one of the most famous stories between Abraham and Isaac?
He's going to kill him.
God says, take your son. Calls him his only son. Is he his only son? No, it's your special son, Isaac, and I want you to go offer him as a sacrifice. A little strange today. Ancient world, strange to offer children as sacrifices?
No.
No, not at all. Only problem is, this is the child through whom he will become the father of many descendants. And if you kill the kid, what happens to his offspring?
They don't
have any. And yet, does he weaken in faith? Oh, God, you forgot about this? I'm sorry, God. Have you not thought this through? Here are the consequences of this. No. What's he do? He gets up the next morning and takes off on the trip. See, the first characteristic that Paul uses to describe the kind of faith that is necessary for God to say, you're righteous, is it doesn't weaken. And that's pretty difficult. The second part is sort of related to doubt. There is no distrust. See, the word faith, or the verb believe, is not mental assent exclusively. It's used that way in our society. but it's not. And in the ancient world, you can read an article about Believe if you want to in Perspectives in Religious Studies. It's in the library, winter 2007, I think, came out on Doubting Thomas, who really isn't being doubting at all. He is being loyal. Because this word believe has to do with loyalty, commitment to someone, trust in someone. And what's the opposite of trust? Distrust. And so the next characteristic he pulls out is no distrust made him waver concerning the promise of God. Still no child, but he grew strong in his faith. Again, strong faith, weak faith. Is it going to return to the topic? Yeah, later on. And the third part, he was fully convinced that God was able to do what he had promised. And what was the promise? Where's that found? Genesis chapter 12. That'd be a great little question for the test, if only it was in Romans. But this is a class on Romans. It's not a class on Genesis. So I'm not going to ask you to know everything out of Genesis. That's a great thing if you were to take a class on the Old Testament with me. Worth some extra credit every once in a while. Being fully convinced that what God had promised, what did God promise? Did Abraham go? And Abraham did what? He went to a land that I will show you, and he had to wander because it really wasn't too easy to get from point A to point B. And I will make your descendants. Now this he told him up in Haran in upper, what is now modern day Iraq. I'm going to have descendants. And how many does he have at that point in time? None. How many does he have when he gets to Canaan? None. How many does he have after he's been in Canaan for a while? None. God is able to do what he had promised. Fully convinced. Why is he convinced? Well, if God, worldview again, can create the world and has the power to bring into existence things that do not exist, what's a little infertility? It's not a problem. You know, if you have somebody who can, they're an Olympic power lifter and they can lift 400 kilos, whatever that is, and you ask them to carry a box of furniture, small furniture in the box, you know, is that hard for them? No. You get somebody who's used to hauling hay bales out in western Kansas, and they're 50 pounds and 50 pounds and 50 pounds and 50 pounds, and one comes along that's 75 pounds because it's full of weeds. That's kind of fun. But they do that all day long for weeks on end, and then you ask them to carry a box of books. Is that difficult? No. But see, he was fully convinced God was able to do what he had promised. Why? Because Abraham viewed that God had brought the world into existence. So his faith and his worldview and his perspective all came together. Now, if Abraham, this is all speculation, had been an evangelical, no, that's the wrong EV, evolutionist, right? An evolutionist that, oh, we just kind of happen to be, does he believe God has the power to bring life from the dead? Probably not. But see, his entire perspective, and that's where it's important to understand Romans in the year 58, when it's being written, they thought differently than we think today. They were concerned with different issues than we are today. And to understand Romans, we have to understand a lot about 58. So he was fully convinced. And so he goes on to talk about Abraham, who's the example. He's going to get eventually to a point of saying, now you Romans, you're kind of like Abraham. Isn't there yet? Right? But Abraham's this example. So, if Abraham is the example of his thesis that the righteousness of God is revealed through faith, right? Abraham becomes the example. The righteousness of God revealed through faith. He answers the question, what kind of faith is that? Oh, he does get to that. Amazing what happens when you're lost because you got up too early that morning. Now, the words, it was reckoned to him. Where are those from? Take a guess. Genesis, inter or intratextual? Intertextual. Were written not for Abraham's sake alone, but for ours. Oh, this story is for our benefit. The promise wasn't just for Abraham, and this account is not just for Abraham, it's for us. Why? So we can learn from Abraham. Right? So it will be reckoned. It, lovely, its are so undefined. It was reckoned, what's the it?
Righteousness.
So it will be reckoned, what will be reckoned? It, righteousness. To us who believe in him, Abraham, no. That would be the objective, believe in person, right? Who raised Jesus from the dead. So, Abraham believes that God can give life to the dead. So what are we supposed to do? The same thing. Believe God can give life to the dead. Now, in Abraham's case, what was dead? Abraham? His ability to have children. It had never experienced any life. He was unable to have children. Ever, up to that point. And then once he was, well, I got to reduce read from 22 to 25. He's got lots of children to come about. Can God give life to the dead? That's the question that the Romans in the year 58 have to answer. Because if God cannot give life to the dead, then everything Paul says and everything Abraham thought is just so much intertextual illusion. Or should I say intertextual illusion? It's illusionary. But if God is able to give life to the dead, then Paul's argument continues to make sense. And it's all based on his presuppositions. So, believe in God, and there's the interesting thing. Who was able to make Abraham have children? The infertility doctor? Specialist? No, in the ancient world, who gave children? God or the gods? Common belief in the ancient world. They had fertility gods, and you would go offer sacrifices if you wanted to have children. That was part of the ritual in the ancient world. Seems a little strange to us today. Because we know it's all about having the correct number of sperm and an egg that's fertile and all sorts of other things. And then when it gets complicated and somebody can have children, we have to find some explanation for that. Too much acid, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that's why people get paid lots of money for being infertility doctors.
And make
octuplets. So believing in God is the first thing. And if one believes that God can give life to the dead, then one is being considered righteous. And one continues to believe that. Oh, let's go back to that example that I just used of Genesis 22. Abram gets up one morning. Now he's Abraham, gets up one morning. And God says, Abraham, take your son, your only son, and offer me to him as a sacrifice on Mount Moriah. Well, what's he going to have to do to his son? Kill him. Can God give life to the dead?
Yes.
So if he actually believes God could give life to the dead, even the ones whose heart has stopped beating, is there any reason he should distrust God on that? No. So part of this argument that Paul is making has everything to do with the concept of who this God is. And Paul's already discussed that in some detail. He'll get to some more detail. God is one. Right? So anything that the gods caused happened by who? the one God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. See, it would be a problem if there were two gods. Because one God would be responsible for giving life to the dead, and the other one would be responsible for, say, rainfall. And if you were trusting the one who was responsible for rainfall to give life to the dead, you'd just be out of luck. And if you were asking the one whose responsibility was give life to the dead to the one who gave rainfall for rainfall, and he couldn't give rainfall, you'd just have a drought. So Paul, takes care of all that. He says there's one God. This God is responsible for all these things. And Abraham believed in this one God who could do all these things. And it was then reckoned to him as righteousness. So, to those who believe in God who raised Jesus from the dead, very important. Some people get the idea in their head, and I can understand it. I've seen the movies. I've seen the visual experiences that Jesus somehow got up on a cross. It's coming up pretty soon. I think Lent is Wednesday. People start looking forward to Easter. It's coming. Got up on a cross, really, which is not a very good way to die, and he died. And they put him in a cold rock tomb, and somehow Jesus, in and of himself, was able to reanimate himself. Right? We get into this image. We have this high Christology. We think of Jesus in a very high terms, and he is God. Well, if he's God, then he couldn't die. So we say, well, he didn't actually die anyway, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And they just go on and on and on. But if you ever read the New Testament, which talks about Jesus' resurrection, Jesus never raised himself. He was raised from the dead by something else. God, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, raised Jesus from the dead. That's what it says. So, who raised Jesus from the dead? Answer's very simple. And was handed over to death for our trespasses. So he's talked about the death, okay, of Jesus. And now he's going to talk about the, put it in the short term that I can spell most of the time, raising or being raised of Jesus in one event, which for Paul it is. So he died for our trespasses and was raised for our, and the term is justification. Justification here is not a verb. It looks like a noun. But it's a noun that describes a verbal process of the verb justify, because you can't take righteousness and put it in there for justification, can you? He was Jesus' resurrection. He was raised for our righteousness. He was raised for our righteousness becoming. Let's see what else we can do in English. Righteousnessification. Right? But if the word is that stem, it's just kind of hard in English because we don't have the same patterns. He was raised so we might be declared righteous. Faith, righteousness, going together. So, he ends this example, right? We have, it's important, follow the argument. Thesis, antithesis, returns to the thesis, gives an example from the Old Testament of Abraham. But is he writing this letter to talk about Abraham? No. And so he very subtly moves from Abraham as example to Jesus as example. Jesus is, should I say, object? No, because the trust is God. One believes God who raised. So it's not just saying, oh, Jesus was raised from the dead, intellectual point one. He died for our sins and was raised for our justification. Intellectual point, point, point. That has nothing to do with our justification. It all is at the beginning. One has to believe God. That's what he's talking about. Abraham did what? He believed God. Abraham believed God and it was credited to him as righteousness. And so what is Paul asking the people in Rome to do in 58? Believe God. That God raised Jesus from the dead. He's not asking them to believe an intellectual point. Now people would testify that. He talks about people who saw Jesus after he was resurrected. He's asking them to do one thing. Believe that God can give life to the dead. Because that's really the basic point. Can God give life to the dead? And by that, he doesn't mean people whose hearts have stopped. That's not the real question. Because that's not Abraham's question. But the question then he raises from greater to lesser or lesser to greater or something like that. If God can take somebody whose heart has stopped and give life to them, can he give life to someone whose heart hasn't stopped? Well, which is harder? Well, this is, of course. So that's where following Paul's argument becomes a little bit complicated. So, and of course, it's not just for the Jews. Why? Because God is one and God is fair to who? The Jews and the Gentiles, to all of them. So, what is faith? Well, maybe we're better understood if we talk about what faith is not. Okay? In the year 58, this doesn't matter what we say today. We're not talking about that. We're trying to understand what Paul would say. And he's not alive today. Faith is not what saves you. God saves you. Now, he may give some words that somehow we might jump to the conclusion faith saves you, but no. For Paul, it's always simple. God saves you. Why? He's Jew. He's Jewish. Who delivered the Israelites out of Egypt? Do not say Moses. Who delivered them out of Egypt? God did. Who delivered them from the exile? God did. Who delivers them? God did. And the word saved is also delivers. Only we have deliver using all sorts of different things. Like you can deliver a baby, you can deliver a newspaper, all sorts of things. But they made this movie called Deliverance. Anybody see that? Problem with intertextual allusions. Deliverance? Anybody see that? Thank you, Tim. Dueling banjos. Anybody ever hear of dueling banjos? You know the music? It was first made popular in the movie Deliverance. You guys got to stop studying so much and watch the movies. You might actually learn something. We'll get on that. Right? Now, we couldn't call that Saverance, could we? Couldn't call that movie Saverance. Doesn't make any sense. But it's the same kind of idea. Faith is not a work. It's not something we do. It is a response to what someone else has done. See, that's why the example is so important. Genesis chapter 12, Abraham's going around going, man, I want to be good, 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 good. I want to be so good, 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 good. Is that how the story goes? No. It says the Lord spoke to Abraham. Who did the speaking? The Lord. God did. Right? Jesus is dead. Who raises him from the dead? God does. So the faith is a response to something that God does. And it's not just believing doctrinal propositions. Two plus two is four. Four and four are eight. Eight and eight are 16. That was a song, too, a long time ago. Back before my actual day, it was a rerun when I saw it. You know this movie? Ellen, you got to watch more TV. Okay? Faith has to do with believing a person. Believing God. Can God do it or not? That's the simple thing. Some of you are going to make a faith commitment to a person. Right, Mr. Luden? Ms. Mitchell, maybe? You're making a faith commitment to someone. Will they be faithful to me? Are you going to trust a bunch of basic truth points? Is that what you mean? A, B, C, they're going to, you know, make these statements, sign it on a piece of paper and say, yes, I am? Or are you trusting that person? You're trusting the person. That's what faith's all about. That's why it's that loyalty issue earlier. It's not just information. All the information in the world, you still won't get married to that person. There has to be a commitment to that person. It's not a subjective feeling or attitude. Faith involves action. What did Abraham have to do in chapter 12 of Genesis? He had to go. We won't talk about what he had to do in chapter 17. I might get fired for that one. Faith is not a one-time event. It begins and keeps going. Back in chapter 12, he believes God. What happens in chapter 15? He believes God. What happens in 17? He believes God. What happens in 22? Believes God. See, if Abraham becomes the example, then Abraham's life, as it's accounted for in Genesis, becomes the example. And it continues on. If you're going to have a faith that results in righteousness, then your faith has to be like that of Abraham. Which may or may not be possible for most of us. We'll get to that later on in Paul's argument, because we got a long way to go. It's not a partial response to God. It involves the whole person. Here's where there is a corrective necessary for the modern world. Because we grew up in America, we believe in a separation of church and state, which means we believe in a separation of church and everything else. Church and work, church and this, church and that. In the year 58, was there a separation of church and state? No. In fact, the leader of the Roman religion was the emperor. There's not a separation, there is a merging and a joining. Everything someone did in the year 58 was considered religious. And when Paul talks about faith, he's talking about that type of involvement. The Western intellectual tradition has separated those, causing us to think, oh, I got faith over here and life over here. Now, it may work in 2009. I'm not saying it doesn't. What I'm saying is, that ain't what Paul meant in 58. To understand Paul's argument is to take some of the precepts that we have and dismiss them. And it's just not a decision. It's not something we do. It's a gift. Has he talked about gifts and works before? Yes. Do you think he'll talk about them again? Yes. And just in case you want to know, these aren't my creative things that I came up with. A guy named Charles Talbert did that. I respect him tremendously. In fact, I wouldn't be here today without him. All I can say that much. I'd probably be stuck painting my truck again. All right? How are we doing here? Oh, I took 4 slides and made it last an hour. Whew! Abraham is the example of the thesis. You think Paul's done? Well, no. He's now introduced a really interesting concept. Something to do with the death and resurrection of Jesus. And he's going to begin to talk about that and some of its implications for his whole thesis. But we'll let you stop at that point in time. Have a wonderful lunch if you get to do so. Some of you I know have other obligations, and we'll see you on Wednesday. Yes, ma'am. Let me shut this off.